any of us who've been in it for long enough, our entire career has been littered with jobs that we didn't get, projects that we thought were going to go for sure, dozens of unproduced scripts littering the floor.
All of us are running into both major and minor failures in Hollywood every single day.
For every success, there is months, sometimes even years, of painful failure.
This is one of the only businesses I can think of where failure is the default. That's the norm. You have to be able to persevere.
Like everything in our business, your hands get calloused and it all bounces off you. That process takes years. That doesn't happen overnight.
I was being told by my manager, it's yours to lose. And I promptly lost it. And I remember thinking like, well, that's it for me. I blew my one big shot. What I've realized from that moment is it's never one big shot. There will be other shots.
Welcome back to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, a podcast about rejection, failure, and adversity in the entertainment industry. I am, as ever, one of your hosts, Dan Rutstein. Noah, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I think we've talked about this before, but I have left Hawaii for the slightly colder Los Angeles, but we're happy to be back. I am thrilled to have our next guest, Kira Snyder, on the podcast. Kira is a longtime TV writer who's worked on such shows as Eureka, Alphas, The 100, The Handmaid's Tale, and is currently working as the creator and showrunner of the upcoming Demimonde for HBO. Welcome, Kira.
Thanks. Happy to be here. Just a quick clarification. I'm not the creator of Demimonde. That actually is J.J. Abrams, but I am one of the three showrunners on that project.
So it wouldn't be a podcast about failure if Noah didn't get something wrong in the opening credits for one of the guests. So, look, Kira, thank you for being part of this. So you've actually listened to about half of our episodes.
I have.
Actually an enormous honor for us because you are so successful, but we're not interested in your success today. You know what this is all about. Mm-hmm. You're having some great successes at the moment. So let's focus away from that. Can you, it's going to go straight in and tell us about the failure that you've had that has lived with you the longest.
Oh, interesting. I'm kind of in the middle of one right now, which we'll see how that shakes out. It's a movie project, which I may have to part ways with. The thing really struck me when I started listening to your podcast. I listened to Mark Bernardin's, and he had come from other industries, and I've also worked in various other industries before focusing on screenwriting, and have not had a great deal of success in those other industries. So I feel like I've sort of failed from a few different types of businesses from one to another. So that struck a chord. And then the other thing that struck a chord most recently is at the beginning of the pandemic, one of my first pandemic projects was to clean out my office like a lot of us did. And I found a stack of rejection letters from all the contests and programs that I had applied to and I'd only held on to for some reason. And it was fun kind of going back through those. And I'm not sure why I held on to them, just out of a sense of stubbornness, perhaps.
So we're now going to focus on this for at least a few questions. So how big is this? Are we talking? Are we talking like there's three letters at the bottom of a box, or have you got like a proper like 50 letters in a box?
I'm somewhere between those. Yeah. It's probably a goodly stack of 10 to 15. Because you know, when I was transitioning from one industry to another, I was working in computer games and looking to move into screenwriting, and applied as writers looking to break in do to, you know, the Warner Brothers program and the Nichols Fellowship and all those, you know, the good reputable contests and programs and fellowships. And I just did not get in for a few years on end. And of course that stung, but I have a strong stubborn streak. So I held onto those letters. And honestly, I think it just took my writing to get good enough to get in. Cause I did get in. That was my break into TV writing. Cause I got into the Warner Brothers writer's workshop. Finally, after a few years of not getting in. And that was also the year that I was physically in LA. So I'm not sure how I thought I would have made it happen when I was in Northern California. Getting rejected from those things, that was right. Looking back at some of those scripts, like, yep, these scripts were not up to snuff, and I had to kind of get those out of my system.
Why do you think you kept them? Did you sort of secretly think, I'm going to keep these so when I'm very successful, I can look back and reflect on them on a podcast? Or do you just keep them because you're a hoarder of things? Or,
you know, I'm not sure why. I had forgotten I'd had them, for one thing. I mean, it was like deep in the drawer of random papers that we all kind of collect. I'm not really a hoarder. So I was surprised to come across those. And again, there were other things in there. Like I'd written like a terrible novel when I was a lot younger, and that didn't go anywhere either. So those letters are in there as well. So it's just a bit of a snapshot of things that were tried and failed. I think I kept it just so as a reminder not to give up. I mean, as a reminder, like, okay, so this didn't work. What can you learn from this and move forward? So yeah, I don't think I had any notion of dragging them out and talking about them to you and your audience today. But it was a thing I was surprised by in the early days of the pandemic and looking for things to keep my mind occupied.
I'm actually really glad we're talking about this, because I think I saw someone post that it's fellowship season right now. And, you know, so many of our listeners apply to all of these things. And I follow a lot of them on Twitter, and they follow me, and I can see the angst and the excitement when someone gets in and when someone doesn't. And most people don't. These fellowships are extremely hard to get into. And I think, you know, people get discouraged when over and over again they come in as a finalist or a semifinalist, but don't actually make the cut to get into the fellowship and hopefully start their career. So I have a twofold question. You had mentioned that you had, you know, it was many years of trying to get into these fellowships. How many years? That's a simple question. And number two, did you ever almost give up, like decide that I'm not, you know, eventually you said you got into the Warner Brothers one. Did you, you know, was there a moment where you almost didn't apply? How many years were you going to give yourself? What was your story behind, you know, keeping going as these rejections mounted up?
Well, part of the answer to that is kind of my making the pivot from one type of work to another. So I worked on a failed game at Electronic Arts called Majestic, and it was an alternate reality game. You know what those are. It's a game that kind of blurs the lines between what's real and what's the game. The game would call you on your phone, and you get emails from characters, and it's a very kind of pervasive game thing. Very much ahead of its time. There haven't really been a lot of commercial ones of those. That was a game where it was a little bit like a TV show. I didn't know it at the time, but we had what I now know is a writer's room, and the game was very episodic. And there was another writer. I was the game designer and lead writer on this project, and we had another writer on it who was a TV writer. She was on the original Beverly Hills 90210, the original Melrose Place, and she said, "This whole thing that we're doing here, it's a lot like working on a TV show. That mix of collaborative creation, individual creation," because then we would go off and write our own pieces. And she said, if you happen to find yourself in LA, you might see about kind of dipping your toe into that. So that was kind of my awakening to TV writing. I was like, oh, maybe I might want to be doing this for a career, because I had been a drama writing major in college. Playwriting was my focus. So I only at that point started thinking about making the change. Now, I was still in Northern California, so I was applying writing specs and applying and not getting in. It was only when I really got to move down to LA, I moved down with work, which is the softest possible landing when moving to LA is when the company moves you there. And when I was here, I was able to really dig in on working on my scripts and also take advantage of all the things that LA has to offer. So now we have podcasts, early days of podcasts then as well. So I moved down in 2005 decided to take it more seriously, making that change, because I was working at Yahoo in the game side of Yahoo, not doing interesting narrative games, very, kind of the smaller casual games. So I wasn't, you know, super in love with my job at that point. And I was in LA, kind of immersed in the entertainment industry, really focused on writing. And that was the year. So I applied kind of that cycle or two for the programs and the fellowships. And I got in the fall of 2006. So I was in LA for a year. I had failures up to that point, and I got in, But the same script that got me into that one got rejected by other programs. So it really just goes to show people who get frustrated and when they apply it, it's such a matter of taste. So I definitely hear that frustration that you talked about, Noah.
So once you're in and you're in rooms and you're a real writer, as it were, because it's so hard to get in and because you'd already had some rejections up to that point, plus you'd worked on games that had failed, were you more sort of guarded and circumspect about whether the shows you were working on were going to work because you'd sort of seen rooms happen and then a product that didn't work come out of them?
It actually took a bit of learning on my side. I think, especially now, the industry has changed quite a bit, even from, so I got my first TV job in 2007, which was a while ago, but not that long ago. And the industry has changed quite a bit, kind of just even in that time. So at that time, though, the utter uncertainty and the nomadic nature of being a TV writer, like, that's something I had to get my head around, because I had come from basically corporate America, where you're at a company for years. When my game I was working on folded, I could have probably found another job in that company on a different game. I ended up going to a different company. But sort of like professional uncertainty was very new to me at the time. And so in my first show, which was a vampire detective show on CBS called Moonlight, which is not the Moonlight you're thinking of. It was originally called Twilight, and it's not that one either. That was my first job coming out of the Warner Brothers program. And it was a very bumpy year, in part because that project was, we had like four showrunners in one season, and that was the year of the writer's strike. And so that was a little bit bumpy. So that was a show that came back after the strike. Not a lot of shows did. We were pretty fortunate in that sense. And then the show got canceled. And I found out, me and my co-writer of that show, we found out the show got canceled while we were in color timing and post-production for the episode. And we were just like looking through our phones. And like, he said, huh. And I said, what? And there was a thing in Variety, I believe, in the trades about how our show got canceled. We're like, well, that's not great. Let's continue with the episode. And we were both so excited because we were both staff writers. This is our first episode of TV. And this was pretty late in the season. So it's different now. Back then, it was still very much staffing season was the time to get a job. And there was a little bit of cable year round, but not a lot. And so we had missed our chance to actually meet and possibly get staffed on another show. So that was the question for me, like, what do I go back to Yahoo and do I ask for my job back? Do I kind of just double down on the writing and stick with it and, you know, live off my savings? Because I'd been very careful to build up some savings. And that's what I did. I mean, there were no jobs to be had for months. So I know I wrote another pilot and I wrote a spec feature and I think I wrote an episodic spec as well. And then, come October, I got submitted to Eureka because they were bringing on some new writers. And that worked out well. And happily, I've been up and running ever since. But that kind of like concern and fear, like and then Eureka, I was on for two seasons and it got canceled. And I was on for Alphas for 1 year and it got canceled. And I was on another show for Stars, which they had basically a mini room. And that did not go forward. So it's kind of understanding the churn of what it means to be a TV writer. I'm still kind of getting used to it, but it was hard this first couple of years.
So Handmaid's Tale, that's kept going. So is that the show that you've been on that's lasted the longest?
That's a show that I've been on personally the longest. I was on that show for the first four seasons. The new season's going to be airing this week. In fact, starts airing on April 28th. The show I've been on the longest was actually The 100. The 100 went seven seasons, which is fantastic. I was on for the first three seasons, and then I moved to go to work on The Handmaid's Tale. So yeah, I mean, and that three seasons on one show, that was amazing. I was just thrilled. And now three seasons is long for like any show's life at all, which is crazy to me.
So obviously, Handmaid's Tale, extraordinary show. Given that what's been going on the last year or so. Do you now wish that you'd made it more bleak and more dystopian because I've caught up with it a bit in the last year?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The way the show has completely unintentionally been a bit of a mirror of the world has been wild. Because of course we write it long before it's shot, right? So there's these strange coincidences that have happened as the show's come out. We did not have a pandemic in The Handmaid's Tale, although in the book there is a pandemic that is one of the causes of the fertility crisis in Margaret Atwood's original novel. So there is a pandemic in the Handmaid universe. But yeah, it's, you know, and the show, some of the criticism of it's like, wow, it's awfully bleak. And we're kind of like, have you looked around? I mean, it's not a rip from the headline show, but the show has worked really, really hard to make sure everything in it is based in reality, either something that has happened before in history or is happening now in real life. And that was one of Margaret Atwood's, one of her guidelines in writing the novel as well that we've carried through into the show.
We had Jose Molina on the podcast a while back, and we talked about briefly taking your work home with you. I think he was on Special Victims Unit, where you have these really intense episodes where it affects you. Now, I'd have to imagine The Handmaid's Tale, because of the mirroring of what was going on in the last 4 years, was affecting the writer's staff. And my question is about your support system. Like, what happens when you take those stories home? Do you have a system in place where you can decompress, not only about what you're writing, but also about the ups and downs of this industry?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's such a good question, because it definitely has changed the kind of the soaking in those kinds of stories and the world we live in from the life of the show. Like, so the show, we were working on it in 2016, Handmaid's Tale season one. That was before the election. It was before the primaries. I don't know about y'all, but we thought the show would be coming out under a different administration and it would be this cautionary tale, like, whoa, that's a bullet dodge. That could never happen here. And as it turned out, we came out in a very different political moment and it ended up being like insanely relevant. And we would much rather have the show been less relevant and a different administration, but we had what we had. The emotional weight of working on the show changed dramatically, certainly for me, year over year. Because as you might imagine, all people working on the show, we are news junkies, we're political junkies, we are very aware of what's going on. So the first chunk of every day would be, you know, ranting and venting and fretting and getting fired up. And then we would move from that dystopia that we had little control over to dystopia we actually did have some control over, which in a way was a little bit more soothing, because at least we could kind of determine what happened there. But it was hard. I mean, honestly, it was hard. I mean, you know, we're writers, we're sensitive people and we want to take that onto the page, but it does have a weight on you as Jose talked about. And so for me personally, that was one of the factors in deciding to move on after season four. Love the show, so grateful to have worked on it and the people I've met and been involved with something that special. But, you know, when I was making that decision in the spring of last year, early pandemic times, and I'm like, I feel like in addition to this being an amazing new opportunity to move to, I feel like it's the right thing for me kind of emotionally and mentally to be in a different space for a while, to kind of get away from the dystopia and play in a different world for a while. So yeah, in terms of support networks, and I'm so glad you bring that up, because that's one of the things I really try to encourage, you know, up and coming writers I speak to, is that writing feels like a very, like I just do it, I'm just writing at home, I'm a lone writer, and it's very collaborative, even in screenwriting, but definitely in TV writing. And also it's really, really hard. So that support network, and that could be your family, it is for me, my husband and these two cats we were talking about, they're not very helpful. They're just cats. And friends as well. So, you know, as you move through your career, maybe the show didn't succeed, but you pick up a couple of really good friendships and you stay in touch with those people. And if they're people that are at your level, and I also really recommend that, you kind of go through your careers together and you are complaining about the same stuff and worrying about the same stuff. So, you know, I have a couple of group texts with groups of friends. And yeah, that's really, especially now in these strange pandemic times, it's been really grounding to have that. So I really encourage people to who are writers looking to get into writing to resist the temptation to be isolated and heads down, because you really, I mean, for your mental health and for your creative health, you need to be engaging with other people.
So you mentioned that in moving on, that your new show, you're one of the showrunners.
Yeah.
Now, given a combination of your experience on Handmaid's Tale, not how the show was run, but the things you were working on, given all of the things that have just happened to people because of the pandemic, given also all the things that are coming out in Hollywood about shows not being run well and people not being treated properly, as you sit down to plan how you're going to run your room and how you're going to do this show, how much time are you devoting to non-show things in the sense of mental health, people's welfare, that part of it? And I don't know if it's difficult to compare, but and how would that have been different in terms of percentage of time spent on that from when you sat down as a writer in someone else's room, you know, a few years back?
Yeah, so the other two showrunners on this, so obviously JJ is working on the show, but he's a busy guy. He's got a lot of things going on. So running the show is myself and Farah Shariat and Rand Ravitch, who co-created Life and have done a bunch of other amazing things. And they're great. So the three of us are kind of this, you know, this trio that will be running the show. The show is at a stage now where we're only starting to kind of get into some things you're talking about in terms of you know, divvying up duties and whatnot. But that kind of management of a staff and, you know, people's emotions and their mental well-being. Yeah, I find, and again, I came in from another industry, so I've managed group before. That's part of being a leader, part of being a boss, if you will. And just kind of looking out for the people that are working with you, that's part and parcel of that. It's harder in over Zoom, because the kind of things that you sort of take for granted when you're in an office, just like, you know, popping your head in someone's office and saying, hey, just like actually checking in, how's it going? Being able to sense that someone may have been struggling in the room or has something they want to talk about, kind of popping in afterwards. What we're doing here, like in Zoom, it's so formalized. You have to schedule a meeting, and there's no kind of like easy popping in and checking in. So we're still trying to do that. We're doing like, you know, it's kind of scheduled, check-ins every so often. And again, that's a carryover from me from having been in other industries. And it's funny because that's not really so much part of the mode of TV. And I've definitely had the experience of people sort of not being clued in why the showrunner wants to meet with them and having a bit of a panic attack. Like, oh, they want to meet with me tomorrow? Like, why? What's going on? It's like, if you sort of say, hey, no, we'll be doing one-on-ones with everybody over the next couple of weeks, just check in how you're doing, offer some feedback, setting those contexts is really helpful. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, I think the things that will be challenging are there, as you know, you've had showrunners on the podcast before. It's a big job. The show's a big show. There'll be plenty of work for everyone to do, and we'll just sort of figure it out. I mean, this the process so far has been really great, and these are great guys. We brought on a couple of additional writers in the fall, and they've been terrific. So yeah, we're excited.
I'm really glad that Dan brought up the old and new Hollywood paradigms that's going on here, because, you know, I feel like, and I think we've all felt it, that there has been a seismic shift in the attention being given to these more sort of the toxic behavior is not okay anymore. And I feel like this conversation has been going on for years, and it kind of maybe got lip service where they'll be like, haha, these are things going on, we have to be better. And maybe people aren't necessarily better because they weren't taking it as seriously, that it's not, you know, that taking care of your staff or being a showrunner who cares, there's all these different elements to running a show that some people weren't very good at. And some people weren't fit necessarily to be at sort of the top of, you know, this group of people running all of this stuff. Do you feel like right now we are at this sort of this shifting point where that people who are running shows have to take it more seriously at risk of their career, but also that it's breeding a different type of showrunner who has to take emotion, like their writer's emotions more into, you know, consideration as they're working?
I sure hope so. I mean, there has been a sea change over the last several years. Certainly with the Me Too movement and sexual harassment, but also more recently, kind of the more toxic bullying behavior, things that, you know, some of the behavior reported is literally criminal, but at minimum would never be. When I would hear some of these stories coming in from working in technology, I'm like, they would call the police. Like you would, or you would get fired. Like you cannot. I mean, just the it, and everyone's experience is going to be different. And goodness knows there's bad actors and bad cultures, and sadly, probably most industries. But it's gratifying to sort of see that ship turning. It's probably not turning quite as fast. I do hope that the people that are moving up are kind of, I hate to say, taking the right lessons from having a bad work environment. Because sometimes you hear like, oh, you know, people came out of a bad work culture and then they perpetuate that. Like it was hard for me, it's gonna be hard for you. That's obviously terrible and wrong. I think folks that are coming up that even if they had a bad experience, take that as a, okay, well, I'm not going to do that. Having a commitment going into working on something to have a different experience. I do wonder, and I don't know if this is something the Guild could help with, kind of getting a real sense of like how endemic the problem really is, how many bad showrunners there really are. It's really hard to tell because there are stories, tons and tons of stories, but I also know lots and lots of good stories, lots and lots of people, good showrunners who, because they are good showrunners, kind of engender more good showrunners. So you look at people who come out of certain camps where the person at the top of the heap is someone who's legendarily good and kind and respectful and empowering. And people who come up in those people's shows, they go on to do that on their own shows. And so that's happening. It could never happen fast enough.
It's interesting. One of the things we've talked about before on this show, and I hope I'm not going to offend all the showrunners, is often showrunners are not brilliantly qualified to be showrunners because it's a different skill set from being an amazing writer to actually, basically, as you say, being a manager or a leader of 200 or 300 people. And it's interesting you've come from, it's less about the fact you've come from tech, but more the fact you've come from a, for want of a better expression, a real company, a grown-up company. Because I was in government for years and I managed a team, a big team. I had 80 people in my team. And I'm used to all of the things you do. Staff objectives, weekly catch-ups, all that stuff. And then when I've moved into the private sector, not in the entertainment industry, but no one does any of this stuff. And it seems very odd that they don't. And you can see how, and I'm lucky to work in companies where there's no bad things happening, but you can see how they could be because no one's controlling anything. So are you weirdly actually, not just because you're a brilliant writer who's been through all of this, but actually because you've had a real job in a real company, that you're perhaps a better showrunner for having generic leadership and management skills as well as an entertainment background now?
I certainly hope so. We'll find out. I do feel like that. I do feel like those skills. I have those skills. I mean, I was older than your average staff writer when I started as a staff writer. I had come in. I already managed not teams as big as yours, Dan, but cross-functional teams, big personalities, tight deadlines, intense, crunch time schedules. Like, I knew how to work with a variegated team on a deadline to create something, engineers plus designers plus artists, like those are lots of different personality types. So I felt like that was a benefit coming in. But yeah, the fact that the idea of 360 reviews, like I think everyone in Hollywood, like they'd be like, what is that? It's such a, for those of you who don't know what that is, that's a review process where you are reviewed by everyone kind of in your work sphere. So people who report to you, people to whom you report, and people who are your peers. And you get a really good picture of how someone is performing that way. There's nothing like that in Hollywood. I really think there ought to be.
I have a question about sort of the nature of all of our beings, I guess, in this industry. That we had Jeffrey Lieber on, and we talked kind of jokingly about his therapist and Lost and all of these different things. But we got to kind of at the core of like, is this your soul's work? And are you happy? And I know writers, it's the weird dynamic where This is the only job you can do. This is where you're absolutely the happiest, but it can also make a lot of people extremely miserable. And I'm curious what you think about that duality and why we all struggle so much in this particular field emotionally.
Well, for myself, it's because I I care so much. Like a lot of your guests have had, I've had jobs I didn't book. I've had movie rewrites I didn't get hired on. I've had pilots that I've sold but didn't go. I've had pilots that I've pitched but didn't go. That hurts every single time. It's frustrating every single time. It causes kind of doubt and insecurity every single time. But then you need to kind of fall in love all over again with the next thing. Like that's the job. And so understanding the resilience it takes to do that. I'm still going through that. Like I mentioned this thing to Dan's first question. Like, there's this movie I was hoping to. Yeah, I've been pitching it. It's an adaptation of a book that I have the shopping rights to, and no one bit. It's like, and it's, I put some of my own money behind this thing, and it's something that I dearly love. It's a book that I've loved for years. People, they like the pitch, they like me, they like my enthusiasm about the project. They just didn't want to buy it, and I'm at the point now where I'm like, I think I need to let it go. And that it hurts. And I also feel like that's, a mistake I made. Like I went out with it as a pitch. Maybe I should have spec'd it. Maybe I should have taken that year and written the script, and then I could have sold the script. But now, a matter of the rights being up, and honestly, my time and my energy are, I don't think I can kind of commit to writing it another, like writing a spec script. So I've let this thing go, and I have been living with it, off and on for the last, two, 3 years, and actively working pitching in the last year. And I just have to let it go and maybe come back to it after some time has passed. But then I need to fall in love with the next thing and make that as good. You got to throw your heart into it every single time. And maybe you need some space, but the new thing is always the thing to be pursuing.
I can't remember who it was now. I remember reading a thing from an actor around, I think he said that everything he works on is the most important thing. Because yes. If you don't treat it like that, then you'll never get anywhere in your career.
Yeah, that was Mads Mikkelsen. And that I saw that too. And I thought it was so brilliant. Because yeah, his point was, don't think about things as stepping stones to the next thing. And it's like, really just, make the thing you're working on the most important thing in the world. And I think it's so genius, because that means you'll kind of, ideally, you'll always kind of be satisfied because you've thrown your whole heart into the next thing. And then, for us as writers, and probably for him as an actor as well, you need to be thinking about probably like the next thing, not five things down the road. I thought that was brilliant. I just really love that observation of his.
Yeah, I was going to make the same comment where that an actor maybe can live in that moment way more than a writer can. And for people who don't fully understand our process, you could be, unless you're on staff on a show, which is sort of all consuming, if you're in development, or even if you see your staff, the end, the writing's on the wall, your show has been canceled, you only have 1 or 2 months, you have to begin stacking projects. You have to begin pitching and preparing and developing, and you don't know what's going to land. And it becomes this sort of endless grind of like reaching far out into the future, hoping that at least one of them is going to pay your bills. And maybe that's connected to why it's just so, like you said, you put your heart into all of these things. Yeah. And one by one, your heart gets cut into little pieces, because the reality is the majority of these shows just don't go.
That's exactly right. And the other takeaway I had from his point, and this does fit for writers, is I completely agree. No, you do have to be thinking about a few projects and have to have them stacked up, because that's just the reality of the work that we're in. But the other thing he says, make it the most important thing, which means like, don't take on something just to take it on. Don't just say yes because someone asked you to do something. Like you have to know that you can fall in love with it. Otherwise it's going to, it'll come across in how you're talking about it, or in success, you'll be chained to this thing that you're not in love with for years. I have one pitch story, which is, I don't know if it's entirely unique, but it certainly was a first for me, and I've not heard it repeated. So I was pitching a book adaptation with this set of producers, And we were got all the pitch all worked up, and we were sitting in the lobby of the studio about to go into the pitch, and they got there a little bit before me, the producers did, and then I came in and had a couple of minutes to spare, and how's it going, you get it, and they kind of were shooting each other looks, and I'm like, what? So it turned out that the night before, the television wing of this particular production company shuttered. The guy in charge is like, we're not going to be doing TV anymore. We're not presenting more TV projects. And so basically the company kind of folded as I was about to go into pitch a thing for the company. And they're like, oh yeah, but the studio still wants to hear the pitch. And I was thinking, how would that work? And secondly, they weren't going to tell me. they said, well, we weren't sure whether to tell you because we thought we might rattle you. I'm like, yeah, it's going to rattle me. There's no home for this thing. It's a dead pitch walking. And I would have been the only person in that pitch who knew this who would not have known this thing had happened, because the studio knew this shingle had shuddered. The producers knew it had shuddered. It would have been me, the poor schmuck writer, like pitching my heart out, not knowing this. So they told me, I did the pitch anyway. It was very weird. It did not sell, of course. But my other big takeaway from that is I realized in retrospect, like, yes, all that happened, but this property, like, I made it work because, maybe it comes from my game design background, my puzzle solving background. Like, I figured out a way to make it work as a show, but deep in my heart of hearts, I didn't love it. And so in success, I would have been attached to this thing for years, feeling kind of not all in on it, which, was probably a blessing in disguise. It did not feel like a blessing at the time. It was pretty awful.
That's an amazing story. Like, you take a step back, it is ridiculous. You're trying to sell something to someone who could never buy it, however well you do, and no one was going to bother telling you, and that somehow is okay. I think we're going to make a list of reasons why projects don't go. We've heard some extraordinary ones. I think that's another new, we keep finding new ways in which it all happens.
Yep, the company just folded up their TV side.
So this is meant to be a podcast about rejection and failure, but I'm going to ask this question anyway. So Noah's very pleased with himself because he asked the other day a guest if they were happy in their life, which was a brilliant question, actually. And he just asked it again. And so, can't have too much happiness, but we're allowed a little bit. But here's a sort of related one, which is, obviously, you've worked on lots of different projects. Which one, and this to use Noah's and Jeffrey Lieber's sort of soul question, which one filled you up the most? Not necessarily had the most commercial success or helped your career the most, but of all the projects that actually went, which I know is only a small percentage of the ones you worked on.
Sure is.
Which one, just that one that you worked on, just made you feel the most fulfilled as the writer that you want to be?
Sure. So I'm actually going to give you two answers. The short answer, briefly, is the one I'm working on right now. But since I can't talk about that, I will give it another answer. I'm so thrilled and excited and grateful for what I'm working on right now. I look forward to talking about it in some point in the future. But the other one, I think would be Eureka. So that was my second show. The first one, this is the show that I got staffed on after almost a year of not working. And there's a few reasons for that. One was just the show itself. If people aren't familiar with it, it was this kind of warm sci-fi dramedy on the Sci-Fi Channel. And it was funny and it was smart. I'm a big science nerd. It was an excuse to look up cool, new, edgy fringe science things and come up with funny stories about them. The characters were great. It was this kind of like, yes, some crazy science thing was always the dilemma of the week, but it was also the solution. So it was like science positive, and it was like low key diverse and inclusive. Before it has the attention deservedly that those things do now. So the show was really a delight to work on and very fun. The other thing was the people I work with. It was a fantastic staff. Everyone's gone on to amazing success and careers. I've had the good fortune of working with some of them off and on as our kind of our billiard ball careers kind of intersect over the years. It was a lovely staff, really great work culture. The folks that ran the show had a really healthy attitude about work and life and emotional balance. We had a lot of fun. We did Secret Santa stuff. I mean, it was just a really great office space to be in. So that was one that really kind of filled me up. And then this is just, this was just a small thing, but something that I would always still think about kind of pretty much every day. So our offices were on the Sunset Gower lot. And that's a lot if you've been on where there's a big parking garage and then, all the buildings, you have to kind of walk across the lot a little bit to get from where you park to where your offices are. And as you're walking across the lot, if you look from the parking garage to the offices, if you look to your right, you can see the Hollywood sign. And that always, it still gives me a little thrill. It's like, it still gives me a little thrill. And it did that. And so getting to see that every day was like, that's pretty great.
I worked on that same lot for years, and I had the same thrill every day, how perfectly framed that Hollywood, and you forget you're in Hollywood. I'm from Hawaii. So when we were first here, it was like, we're in Hollywood and blah, blah, blah. And you just forget. And then you have moments. And I had two moments on that lot. One where I bumped into, I don't know him at all. I'm not name dropping because I know him, but I literally slammed into a man, and I look up, and it's Aaron Sorkin, who was just doing news media or something at that point on that same lot. And he looked at me, saw like the recognition on my face, and he could just see that, yeah, I'm Aaron Sorkin. And we didn't say any words. The second time I was just wandering to a food truck. I'm like, oh, I'm just really hungry. And standing next to me was Quentin Tarantino, because they were doing Hateful Eight on that lot as well. So I'm like, you forget, you just get so lost in your...
Oh, sure.
Whatever you're doing. And then you're like, you have a Hollywood moment. And those two were definitely Hollywood moments, framed by the Hollywood sign in the back. And you're like, wow, this is kind of cool. This is maybe why we love it. I don't know. This is all my very long-winded way of getting to our final question, which, since you've listened to our podcast a number of times, you know what's coming. But what is one piece of advice that you would give to an up-and-coming writer who's trying to get into the business today?
Yeah. I did listen to a bunch of these, and so much good advice. A lot of the advice I often give had already been covered, so I was thinking about something different. Your whole podcast is about cultivating resilience, which is something I often tell people. Finding or building a community of peers is another one. But the one I was thinking about specifically, and I was kind of thinking about some of the things that my own experiences, and that I hopefully is relevant to your listeners, is to look for the good in every failure, like every mistake, every failure. There's something good to take away from it. And you might have to dig a little bit. Sometimes it's like, well, I'm not gonna do that again. That's also learning, but there's always something. I mean, if a show gets canceled, you meet really great people, like I talked about. You learn about the industry. You learn like, okay, so, this is a thing that's not going to sell this year. Maybe it will next year. Maybe I need to work on something that I also love. You learn more about your own writing. For me, we have to be careful with our time as writers, because as we all know, and other guests of yours have indicated, the industry will definitely exploit us for our free labor. The whole idea of like pitching for free, like all the work it takes to like work up a take, like, I hate that word. It's a take. It's like, no, you're asking me to figure out your story and somehow convey it to you in like 15 punchy minutes. That's really hard. So you have to practice, being guardful with our time. But every time I've worked on a pitch that didn't go, and a lot of them haven't, I've had practice breaking story. So my own writing, my own storytelling gets better the more times I do that. Or sometimes the good and the failures, a story to tell folks like you guys on podcasts. And the other thing about looking for the good in every failure is not just the actual takeaway and the lesson, but I also think it's kind of attitudinal. It is really easy to get burned down, burned out, tired, jaded, frustrated, God help us, cynical. And that energy, that darker energy, like that shows up on the page, that definitely shows up in meetings, that shows up in the room. So if you're actually looking for the good, like that kind of optimism, positivity, wanting to fall in love with a thing like that, you know, that energy is something that you want to bring into each assignment, each room, each show.
Brilliant. Kira Snyder, designer of at least one failed computer game. Thank you very much for being part of our podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Kira.
Thanks. Take care.
All right, that does it for us today. I want to thank you for tuning in to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to me on Twitter. I am at N. Evslin.
Wait, are we not bothering to talk about the other Twitter account, given we have this great social engagement and people never bother to actually include me, whose idea it was to do this podcast in the first place?
You have a Twitter account?
I do have a Twitter account. It's at Dan Rutstein. And not only, Noah, do I have a Twitter account, I also have two other podcasts. And some of our listeners have been saying, Dan, please tell us about your other podcasts. So our other podcasts are... what are my other podcasts? Oh, yes. United States of Dramerica, where I share a glass of whiskey and have a fascinating conversation. And America, the Beautiful Game, where I talk about soccer in America and what it can learn from Europe.
For our repeat listeners, you can probably stop listening when Dan starts talking about his second and third podcast. That brings us to the end of another great episode. We, as always, want to thank our wives for putting up with our nonsense.
That's good. That'll do.